SS and police forces in the Soviet Union would extend their killing to Jewish women and children. Frontline and rear area army units would grease the wheels of the entire process. July brought the first serious threat to the invasion timetable. With the Germans apparently holding the initiative at the start of the month, Hitler hoped to persuade the Japanese to attack the Soviet Union from the east. At this particular stage, that might have been more than the Red Army could have withstood. But the Japanese, already committed to war in China, were more interested in expanding into the Pacific and Southeast Asia. The Germans, then, would have to finish off the Soviet Union on their own. Yet only in the central sector of the front had the Germans achieved a major operational victory, with their destruction of the Minsk and Białystok pockets. The same could not be said of the front's northern and southern sectors. And even in the center, the number of Red Army formations the Germans had destroyed was not enough to throw open the route to Moscow. Furthermore, German intelligence consistently underestimated the total number of divisions available to the Red Army. For instance, before the invasion, the FHO had blithely assured Barbarossa's planners that the Red Army could not possibly transport its Far Eastern divisions westwards in time for them to fight the invaders. Now, with the campaign underway, the German army was constantly surprised by the Red Army's strength because its own frontline intelligence officers were too often not up to the job. But the German army's leadership only had itself to blame for this, for the General Staff Regulations of 1941 had downgraded intelligence even further. They charged a commander, together with his chief of staff or his operations officer, with the main responsibility for judging the enemy's situation. The commander's intelligence officer was only supposed to assist in this process. As General von Seeckt had opined, uncertainty and chance are inseparable characteristics of war. No understanding can control them. No beam out of the brightest and sharpest intellect can illuminate them. Only the will of the commander can dominate them. The clarity of the will is the only light in the darkness of doubt and the future. By now, moreover, there was a new influx of intelligence officers, for the greater part reservists rather than staff officers who usually had to learn on the job rather than through specialist training. They were also inferior in rank to an operations officer. The Soviets thus continued to resist on a scale that bewildered the Germans. Within a fortnight of the invasion, General Hulder was triumphantly declaring that it was probably no overstatement to say that the Russian campaign has been won in the space of 2 weeks. By the end of July, however, an increasingly agitated Hulder was drastically revising his opinion. "We have underestimated the Russian colossus. At the outset of the war, we reckoned with about 200 enemy divisions. Now we have already counted 360. These divisions indeed are not armed and equipped according to our standards, and their tactical leadership is often poor, but there they are, and if we smash a dozen of them, the Russians simply put up another dozen." Mechanized and infantry divisions alike were increasingly exhausted by the constant fighting and advances. A letter of early August by Wachtmeister Josef L. captured the experience of both in microcosm, together with the creeping feeling that this was a campaign without end. "Weeks of endless grinding slog lie behind me. We've been shown the way to the east through blazing sun, cold nights, foot-high sand and swamps. Nearly 1,200 kilometers, 750 miles, of marching lie behind us. Only those who have fought in the campaign in the east can grasp how much all this has cost us in nerves, sweat and effort. Last Sunday our position took a direct artillery hit, which cost the lives of our company commander and two runners." The exhaustion he described was worsened by the army's mounting supply problems. These were less acute for Army Group North, which benefited from the superior rail and road networks of the Baltic states and from its proximity to Estonian harbors. Supply problems were much worse further south, not least in the particularly crucial sector of Army Group Center. Trucks drawn from civilian transport stocks or Western European production sources proved particularly brittle. By 20 July, more than 30% of Army Group Center's vehicles had broken down. Trucks also consumed an alarming amount of fuel in these conditions. the fuel they required for 100 kilometres, 62 miles, in the relatively benign terrain of Western Europe, for instance, covered just 70 kilometres, 44 miles, in Russia. The Germans found that the Soviet rail system, which they increasingly had to bank upon as they advanced further east, was also thoroughly unreliable. OKH logistical planners had disregarded the fact that German rolling stock was too small for the Soviet railway gauge. This error was less crass than it may sound, for German engineers could at least narrow the track. But converting track was a Herculean task. Soviet scorched earth measures, fighting on the ground, and the Luftwaffe's bombardment from the air had all wrought immense damage upon railway lines, water stations, signal equipment, rolling stock, telephone lines, bridges, and engine sheds. The Army's technical railway troops lacked manpower and materials. For instance, only 16 of its railway units were fully motorized, and two-thirds had no vehicles at all. There were other problems. Russian coal burned inefficiently in German engines, and, most basically, there were not enough railways. In particular, Army Group Center's three armies and two panzer groups had only one main line to supply them. German troops were also increasingly plagued by heat, dust, and thirst. "If you could see me," wrote Corporal Franz F. of the 12th Panzer Division on 12 July, "you would run away from me. I haven't washed for 4 days, and I look like a chimney brush." Dust also affected mechanized transport, attacking air filters, increasing oil consumption, and damaging engines. The infantry's particular physical exertions caused them to suffer especially. "Every day is the same," declared Unteroffizier Willy P. of the 7th Wave 167th Infantry Division, fighting under the 4th Army on 15 July. "Blazing heat from morning until evening, and dust that gets into everything. The latter is really doing for us. The best we can hope for is a billet with 3 or 4 wells in the village between 800 men. As well as the dust on ourselves, we also cop the dust from our endless vehicle columns. So you can well imagine that day in and day out we look like someone has vomited all over us." As for thirst, Lieutenant Helmut D. wrote, for example, on 6 August, "There was a terrific heat, and after the battle we could hardly speak from raging thirst. A shallow pond full of frogs provided a little respite." Between a mechanized army racing to maintain a merciless timetable and a largely unmechanized force trailing in its wake, inevitable tensions now erupted. General Guderian and Field Marshal von Kluger, already ill-disposed towards one another, fell out explosively over the gaps opening up between Guderian's Panzer Group II and Kluger's 4th Army. Guderian's memoirs recall the exceptionally heated conversations between the two men. While Kluger wished to stall the Panzer's advance to safeguard the flanks of the German advance, Guderian accused Kluger of trying to stop the advance of the Panzers at every difficulty arising in the rear. But the wrangle between the two generals was merely a symptom of the ever-widening gap between the Germans' strategic aims and their actual means. It was not just that the footsore infantry were unable to keep up with the Panzers. An unexpectedly tenacious Soviet resistance, a transport and supply network even more ruinous to German logistics than anticipated, and the excessive time needed to encircle, destroy, and mop up the huge pockets of Red Army troops were all debilitating panzer and infantry divisions alike, and with them the whole timetable of Operation Barbarossa. Between 7 July and 5 August, the Battle of Smolensk raged. During these weeks, the city and its surrounding region became the fulcrum of Germany's summer campaign in the east. At the start, General Halder was confident of success, followed by a decisive advance on Moscow. By the end, the Germans had won the battle, but at the cost of all their hopes of achieving a swift, decisive strategic victory. Smolensk is situated in the middle of the land bridge between the great natural obstacles of the rivers Dvina and Dnieper. It was this land bridge that provided the swiftest, surest route to Moscow. However, the Germans had to spend the battle advancing on and taking Smolensk itself, while fighting off Soviet counterattacks from the east. This double challenge placed the Germans under intense pressure. The Western Army Group's commander, Marshal Semyon Timoshenko, targeted his counterattacks at isolated units with unprotected flanks. The Soviet counterattacks were poorly coordinated, in large part due to their slapdash reconnaissance. But Timoshenko had numbers on his side. Although the Germans had inflicted 400,000 losses on the Red Army's Western Front during the campaign's first 6 weeks, the Soviets were able to mobilize another 800,000 men by the end of June, another 600,000 in July, and almost the same amount in August. During the same period, the Red Army increased its total number of divisions from 252 to 384, including the 100 series of tank divisions. The newly mobilized troops were poorly trained and equipped, but there were a great many of them, and over half were sent to the sector of front west of Moscow. By late July, moreover, Red Army units were already equipped with Katyusha multiple rocket launchers. They were not the most accurate of weapons, but as a company of the 109th Infantry Regiment attested in late October, they had a lacerating effect upon morale. With a dreadful howling noise and like comets with red tails, the missiles tear through the air. On impact, they explode with a thundering crack. Their effect on morale is great, as is the effect of the sheer number of explosions in the smallest area. To make matters worse, the VVS was ominously reminding the Germans that they had only managed to destroy its air power near the frontiers. Although its attacks were relatively ineffective, they put the already overstretched Luftwaffe under yet more strain. By 12 July, 40% of the combat-ready aircraft the Luftwaffe had committed to the invasion had been destroyed or damaged. Now, rather than take the attack directly to the VVS, it was needing to focus on supporting ground operations. The terrain around Smolensk also hindered the Germans. "The landscape is very convenient for defense," wrote Corporal Josef M. of the 5th Infantry Division, fighting under the 9th Army. "It consists of large, deep woods, big areas with 3-meter-high, 10-foot-high undergrowth, heathland, and high rye fields. The enemy is able to conceal himself very well, and it's very unpleasant attacking an enemy whom you can't see. The Russian defends himself extremely bitterly and underhandedly. Single sharpshooters can hold up whole battalions." Finally, during the first week of August, the German 2nd and 9th Armies were able to liquidate the Smolensk encirclement and with it three Soviet armies. Operationally, Smolensk was another great victory for the Germans. They captured 400,000 prisoners, including over 300,000 in the Smolensk pocket itself. But strategically, Smolensk achieved nothing. Neither side won the battle emphatically. However, in the words of David Stahel, the victor was simply the side with the least to lose from the failure. By this definition, the real victory was the Red Army's, for it just needed to be still in the fight after the battle. Army Group Center, by contrast, was rapidly approaching exhaustion. The 18th Panzer Division, for example, was already exhausted by 26 July. "The men are indifferent, apathetic, partly suffering from crying fits, and not cheered up by this or that phrase. Food is being taken only in disproportionately small quantities." In July 1941 alone, the Germans suffered 63,000 dead on the Eastern Front, and the Battle of Smolensk was the main contributor. Panzer losses caused by enemy action or overexertion were also enormous. By 29 July, for instance, 71% of Panzer Group II's tanks had been lost or were under repair. Almost as if to rub the Germans' noses in it, Timoshenko launched a further counteroffensive between the first and third weeks of August. This would eventually fail, due in large part to the efforts of one of Guderian's formations, 24 Panzer Corps. But in the meantime, it caused Army Group Center still further damage. After the Battle of Smolensk, the exhausted panzer groups had to recharge and refit before resuming the offensive, so it was the infantry of the 4th and 9th Armies that had to hold off Timoshenko's forces. Moreover, the guns the Red Army deployed from its still massive artillery force inflicted severe attritional losses upon Army Group Center. At the end of the third week of August, Bock wrote, "I am being forced to spread the reserves which I have scraped together for the hoped-for attack behind my front just to have some degree of security that it will not be breached. If, after all the successes, the campaign in the East now trickles away in dismal defensive fighting for my army group, it is not my fault. Then, on 12 August, came reports that the Soviets were concentrating powerful forces for the defense of Moscow. Yet the main advance Hitler now had in mind, to which he decided to divert Panzer Group 2, was in the south. Partly he was being opportunistic. The weaker Soviet forces there now promised an easier victory than in the center. But a drive south, as well as one to the north, to which Hitler committed Hoth's Panzer Group 3, was entirely of a piece with the objectives Hitler had particularly coveted before the start of the invasion. It would enable him, he believed, to seize Leningrad in the north, and, above all, the economic resources of the Ukraine and the Donbass region in the south. As he went on to proclaim in August, "The most important task before the onset of winter is not to get Moscow, but to get the Crimea and the industrial and coal region of the Donets, to pinch out Russia's oil supply from the Caucasus, to besiege Leningrad and to link up with the Finns." Even before the Battle of Smolensk was over, Hitler was beginning to perceive that the Soviet Union might not be defeated in 1941, and that grabbing more economic resources was now the only useful course of action. A directive he issued on 14 July proclaimed that the Germans must seize more raw materials, in other words, launch a reinforced drive on the south, if they were ultimately to prevail. Hitler's conviction may have hardened after 22 July, when at a meeting with Brauchitsch, the army commander-in-chief apparently let slip Halder's duplicitous attempts to manipulate the direction of the main invasion effort. His convictions certainly hardened in the face of the military developments of July and early August. Not only were Army Group Center's infantry divisions facing Soviet counterattacks northeast, east, and southeast of Smolensk, the northern and southern flanks of Army Group Center itself were threatened. Advancing to the north and south would remove this danger by straightening out the line. Halder's furtive efforts to keep the campaign focused on Moscow had failed. He would now spend considerable time and energy privately blaming Hitler for the catastrophe he believed was about to unfold. During the post-war years, numerous former generals, Guderian among them, would claim that Hitler's failure to take the open road to Moscow in August 1941 destroyed Germany's best chance of defeating the Soviet Union that year. Lieutenant Colonel Siegfried Westphal, operations officer for 27 Corps during the 1941 campaign, remarked after the war, "Instead of an operation of the clenched fist, Hitler chose an operation of the outspread hand." There was some sound thinking behind Hitler's decision. The road to Moscow was not open. Soviet opposition was weaker in the south because the Soviets were strengthening their forces before the capital, and Moscow's defenses were stronger in August than they had been in July. The ferocity of the fighting around Smolensk was probably a foretaste of what the Germans would have faced had they lunged at the capital straight away. Nor could the Germans immediately jump off towards Moscow anyway. The Battle of Smolensk had exhausted their panzer forces, and urgently refitting these was the main priority before advancing further in any direction. The problem was less Hitler's thinking than the insoluble dilemma the Germans had created for themselves. Driving on the south made sense economically, and driving on the north and south made sense operationally, but the only target that might make sense strategically, and even this is debatable, was Moscow, and Moscow was beyond the Germans' reach. The direct reason why the Germans could not defeat the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941 was that they failed to destroy the Soviet armies at the campaign's very start. Yet this aim had never been realistic. The Soviets were now holding the Germans at bay, if precariously, so that they could not only organize their defenses more effectively, but also transfer much of their industrial plant out of harm's way beyond the Urals. By September 1941, about 2,500 enterprises had already been successfully moved east. This was the first step in a production miracle that would progress spectacularly as the war on the Eastern Front continued. In view of this, it can be easy to forget how heavily the Wehrmacht hammered the Red Army, particularly in the center of the front, during the opening weeks of Operation Barbarossa. This success had been due to Soviet ineptitude on several counts. Stalin's catastrophic misjudgments, inexperienced and often incompetent leadership at various levels, the troops' poor standard of training, and supply shortages, particularly in fuel and suitable tanks, to name but four. Yet the German army was only able to exploit this ineptitude so fully thanks to its own superior tactics, training, operational art, and combined arms proficiency. But much more was needed to translate the Germans' operational successes into strategic triumph. They might have achieved this had Japan committed to the war in July 1941. However, while the Japanese could not be blamed for avoiding a campaign in which they had no direct interest, the Germans could be blamed for going into it ill-prepared. Theoretically, a German victory during the campaign's opening weeks was not impossible, but the Germans had left no margin for error. Strategic triumph depended far too much on an utterly shambolic performance from the Red Army, and an utterly faultless one from the Germans themselves. Impressive as the Germans' performance usually was, it fell far short of faultless. Their logistical and intelligence failures helped see to that. And inept as the Red Army's performance often was, its soldiers' obdurate resistance slowed the Germans and eroded their strength enough for the Soviets to be able to transfer industrial plant eastwards and for the Red Army to cobble together a new front before Moscow. One thing that helped to make the Red Army so resilient, its numerous mass surrenders notwithstanding, was the Germans' own ruthlessness. Nazi ideology, the criminal orders, the Soviets' own methods, and the fighting conditions in general all helped to drive this ruthlessness. How far each of these forces fueled the brutality of German troops might vary from unit to unit. A unit's social and regional background, still more so its particular function, were among the things that could help determine how ruthlessly or otherwise it comported itself. Nevertheless, the Wehrmacht itself was more to blame than the Red Army for the spiral of terror that unfolded. Most directly, the Germans' killing of Red Army commissars, and more sporadically of surrendering Red Army soldiers, did not weaken Soviet resistance, but strengthened it. The relatively quiescent conditions in the occupied rear, meanwhile, might have caused many units to behave more moderately towards the occupied population, but not towards its Jewish sections. This was a further sign of the ideological currents that animated the Army's war in the East. At the front line, given the Red Army's sheer size as well as the ferocity of its resistance, it is unsurprising that the Germans' casualty rates were soon mushrooming and their exhaustion levels spiking. By failing to break the Red Army during its opening weeks, Operation Barbarossa's chance of delivering a swift, decisive strategic triumph had disappeared by early August. The following weeks and months would see the strategic initiative in the entire war begin to slip from the Germans' grasp. Part 3. Losing the Initiative. Chapter 9. Barbarossa Undone, 1941. "The time ticks for the enemy, not for us," opined General Guderian on 10 August 1941. But while the Germans would strain every sinew between September and December and achieve further operational successes, strategic triumph would continue to elude them in the East. In the face of ongoing losses and unattainable victory, generals and soldiers in the field grew frustrated to the point of desperation. As a result, many started increasingly to exhibit the full extent of brutality that was ingrained in the criminal orders issued before the campaign. During the summer of 1941, German troops had implemented such orders brutally but selectively. The conditions they faced during the autumn and early winter brought Nazi ideology much further to the fore, as it increasingly suffused both the way the army fought and the way it treated the occupied population. Guderian's observation that time ticked for the enemy now applied not just to the war in the East, but to the war as a whole. Hitler was conscious of what Germany's other enemies were doing. In August, Britain and the United States, still officially neutral, even though its president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, sought to commit it fully to the Allied side, signed the Atlantic Charter. Here they declared their wish to see sovereign rights and self-government restored to those who have been forcibly deprived of them, and a peace which will afford to all nations the means of dwelling in safety within their own boundaries. The following month, they assured the Soviet Union of extensive economic aid at the Three Powers Conference. These developments convinced Hitler that the global war he had predicted was imminent. The main danger it would pose would be the combined economic superiority of the coalition Germany would face. This reinforced Hitler's belief that a swift end to the war was not possible, and that the Germans would prevail on both the Eastern Front and on the global scale only if they could seize the resources of the southern Soviet Union. While Hitler was reconciled to a lengthier campaign in the East, ordinary soldiers contemplated the prospect with fear. On 22 August, Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division expressed his hope that a new decisive operation will soon get going and set the seal on the Russians' defeat. One does not talk of winter here. God help us if we have to spend this cold, dark time in snow and ice, here where no person should live, among burned villages and towns, endless forests and swamps. The passing of time also unsettled Private Werner F. of the 12th Panzer Division. The nights are already getting noticeably cold and damp. Thank God I have enough blankets so I don't freeze. Now the fields are empty and have all been reaped. When we came, the corn was still green. The troops found the terrain of the Ukraine in particular to be disorientating because of the sheer sameness of the landscape. Captain Friedrich M. of the 73rd Infantry Division, advancing through the far south of the Ukraine with the 11th Army, wrote in mid-August, "One day is the same as another, just as the landscape and villages are all the same and the routes that we march along. There is a monotony to all the days, when one can no longer distinguish different days of the week, but only the date itself." The ferocity of the fighting did not abate. The transfer to Army Group South of General Guderian's Panzer Group 2 was intended to give Rundstedt's armies the offensive power they needed to encircle and destroy the Soviet forces facing them. But the overall task of encircling and destroying the Red Army's southern forces west of the Dnieper, in accordance with the Barbarossa Directive, was immense. Through most of August, the Battle of Dnepropetrovsk tied up General Eberhard von Mackensen's III Corps. The Germans committed 50,000 troops to the operation, including the 198th Infantry Division. The urban fighting they experienced exemplifies the severity of the struggle the German army faced as it continued its painful eastward progress. During the German army's earlier campaigns, the panzers' rapid advance had often bypassed urban centers. In the Soviet Union, the Germans had no such choice. Urban centers were major transport and communication hubs that they had to capture if they were to take apart the Soviet fronts. Nor, when it came to the larger towns and cities, did they have the option simply of bombardment with artillery or air assault. That would merely create an enormous amount of rubble which Red Army troops could defend more easily. On the other hand, the Germans' eventual capture of Dnepropetrovsk demonstrated how much their urban warfare tactics had improved since Warsaw in 1939. In particular, they no longer made the mistake of sending in a panzer spearhead without direct infantry support. By now, the Germans had learned to play to their strengths. One of these was the special-purpose Combined Arms Battle Group. For urban assaults, battle groups usually comprised a panzer platoon, a panzer jäger, anti-tank company, an artillery battery, assault infantry, and engineers. This organization gave the Germans flexibility, enabling panzers and infantry to protect one another. The panzer jäger dealt with any Soviet tanks, pioneers cleared obstacles and strong points, and artillery provided heavy firepower. In close-quarters urban fighting, there was a risk of German artillery hitting its own men, so light howitzers moved with the infantry to provide safe and accurate support. The infantry themselves found hand grenades the best means of clearing snipers and machine gun nests. The German troops who fought in Dnepropetrovsk also widely displayed the flexibility and aggression that were the hallmarks of Auftragstaktik. Yet still, the Germans' progress through Dnepropetrovsk was slow and painful. The panzers were not in their element, and their infantry support should have been more numerous. Soldiers needed to take Pervitin, not to enable them to race ahead, as in the West in 1940, but simply to keep them going. In the close and confused urban setting, the artillery expended ammunition rapidly amid the fierce fighting and could not always provide effective support. Maps were often inadequate, though the troops did improvise using captured maps and aerial reconnaissance, and communication difficult, with the panzers using radio, but the infantry needing to use less versatile wire connections or even runners. Furthermore, the need to move fast left many pockets of resistance to mop up. On one occasion, the Germans had to clear Red Army troops from a well-fortified barracks from where they could observe the Germans with ease. The Soviets counterattacked with tanks no fewer than 20 times, and the German infantry lacked the ammunition with which to repel them conclusively. Two regiments were thrown in without proper medical support, and medical teams located further behind the lines became exhausted as the wounded poured in. Yet again, however, Stalin's miscalculation was to gift the Wehrmacht a huge operational success, just as it had further west in June and early July. He refused to allow his troops to withdraw, partly because abandoning the south would mean abandoning the Russian medieval capital of Kiev. The weight of history attached to Kiev made Stalin feel compelled to hold it. The Germans committed three infantry armies, Kleist's Panzer Group 1 and Guderian's Panzer Group 2, to the task of encircling and destroying the Soviet forces in and around Kiev. During the last week in August, Army Group South was able to match Guderian's southward turn by establishing a bridgehead at Kremenchuk, 260 kilometers, 163 miles east of Kiev. The two forces completed their encirclement of the Soviet armies on 15 September, and 4 days later the Red Army troops in the pocket began surrendering in droves. While German claims that 665,000 prisoners were taken are probably exaggerated, the figure was clearly huge. Individual units took enormous hauls of prisoners. On 21 September, for instance, the 1st Battalion of the 35th Infantry Regiment, serving under the 25th Infantry Division in Panzer Group 2, took 1,069 prisoners for the loss of 4 dead, 9 wounded, and 4 missing. The victory also opened up new opportunities for the Germans. The Soviets in the south were now exhausted, and Rundstedt was able to encircle and annihilate further Red Army formations in the Battle of the Sea of Azov. General of Infantry von Manstein's 11th Army broke into the Crimea. General von Kleist advanced on the Donbass. Army Group South's advance also safeguarded Army Group Center's southern flank. Yet, predictably by now, the cost to the Germans of the whole Kiev operation was extremely high. They suffered 50,000 killed. They could particularly ill afford the losses the mechanized divisions had incurred. On 20 September, for instance, Panzer Group 2 reported that it had lost 30-40% of its wheeled transport. By the end of September, the Germans had lost 925,000 men on the Eastern Front. The losses for the campaign's first 3 months were actually worse than they would be for the next three. 583,000 were lost during that period, a shortfall that the replacement system could not make up even with the somewhat lighter losses from October to December. "It is often a misused statement," remarked the American journalist Howard Smith shortly after he left Germany at the end of 1941, "but it is true in the case of the Russian war that Germany has been winning herself to death." That the generals themselves feared this scenario is shown by the alacrity with which they now began falling out over the prospect. Commanders in Army Group South, such as Field Marshal von Reichenau and General von Weichs, criticized Field Marshal von Bock for obsessing over Moscow. Generals in Army Group Center, such as Guderian, remained equally convinced that Moscow should always have been the priority, though Guderian had turned south readily enough after Hitler had got to work on him. And for Army Group North, Field Marshal von Leib lamented that he had been relegated to waging a poor man's war. Thus preoccupied with what was going on in their own sectors, the generals were betraying that flaw in the German command ethos that elevated operational ability at the expense of seeing the wider strategic picture. Between the late summer and early winter of 1941, as the front-line fighting dragged on, the German army began resigning itself to occupying large parts of the Soviet Union for longer than had been planned. Some officers were prescient enough to recognize that alienating the population was counterproductive. For instance, at the start of October, General von Weichs, now commander of the Second Army, urged his subordinate formations to discriminate in their treatment of civilians and not to treat them all as partisans. The 4th Mountain Division, too, sought to treat the population with some consideration. Its intelligence section compiled a report at the end of October in which it judged the Ukrainian population as willing and accommodating. The divisional commander, General Egelzer, also went directly against the provisions of the Barbarossa Decree by stripping his regimental and battalion commanders of the freedom to order reprisals. Examples such as this were of a piece with the relative restraint that many army units had hitherto exercised towards the occupied population despite the injunctions of the criminal orders. Yet the further east the Germans advanced, the more severe the social and economic mayhem they encountered. The Soviets had uprooted not just industrial plants, but also thousands of specialist workers, civil servants, doctors, and managers. The damage this wrought upon the social and economic fabric of these regions was enormous. The details were described by the Einsatzgruppen, which as part of their intelligence-gathering role compiled reports on the political situation in the occupied territories. In mid-July, Einsatzgruppe B, following Army Group Center's advance through Belarus, reported, "The flight of the functionaries has brought life in general to a standstill. The population pours back to the cities in its thousands, where instead of any basis of life it finds only ruins. Because the collective farms aren't functioning and the depots stand empty and unoccupied, the small shops and distribution points cannot function either. Despite the harsh measures that have been put in place, plunder is universal." The anti-Slavic sentiments that many officers and soldiers harbored were now hardened by the exigencies of an increasingly arduous, chaotic situation, for which the army occupation forces were almost entirely unprepared. Furthermore, the military campaign's unexpected duration led frontline units to seize supplies and accommodation from civilians on a massive scale, and in an often wild, unregulated manner. The devastating effects of this would become manifest during the winter of 1941 to 1942. Depending on their ethnicity and how useful the Germans considered them, some civilian groups suffered under the German occupation more than others. Generally, however, the increasingly brutal and rapacious character of the German occupation in late 1941 divested most of the occupied population of any illusion that the Germans were liberators. An October report by the 403rd Security Division, operating in the Army Group Center rear area, outlined why the population's initially pro-German mood was evaporating. Hunger, the long duration of the war, treatment of the Jews, punishment beatings, and the scale of German administration, all of which, they feel, points towards the permanent subjugation and annexation of their land. The general population was worst affected by the Germans' actions over two interconnected areas, the food supply and the pacification campaign. On 5 August 1941, Einsatzgruppe B reported, "East of Minsk, the provisioning situation is catastrophic, for all supplies were destroyed by the Soviets." The social and economic havoc was partially heightened by urban dwellers conducting mass foraging expeditions, or Hamsterfahrten, into the surrounding countryside. But they were also heightened by the copious requisitioning being conducted by German army troops compelled to live off the land by their army's own high-level planning. For instance, the 6th Infantry Division, which served with the 9th Army on the northern wing of Army Group Center, needed a full 30 tons of rations each day. As one soldier from the division later recalled, "While in France the daily discussions were mostly about girls, in Russia we talked mostly about food." One reason why Belarus felt the troops' depredations so severely was that it was not a rich agricultural region to start with. In particular, the German troops found that fruit and vegetables were extremely scarce. The spoliation by German troops was not part of the systematic hunger plan drawn up before the invasion. Indeed, military administrators in the Soviet Union were already realizing that a lengthy campaign and lengthy occupation required them to keep more of the occupied population alive and relatively healthy so that it could work for them. A more brutally pragmatic consideration was that, with the fighting still raging, the Germans did not have enough troops to cordon off the regions earmarked for starvation. Rather, the troops' plundering reflected a desperate need for both rear area and front-line army units to try and reprovision themselves in advance of winter. The effects for the population as winter approached, of course, were economic misery and the spectre of starvation. A commandant under the 123rd Infantry Division, serving with the 16th Army in Army Group North, described one of the desperate scenes that resulted. Troops physically abused civilians who tried to protect their property. In one particularly disturbing case, a 75-year-old woman on her knees, begging mounted troops not to take her last cow, was punched repeatedly in her face. To try and keep such marauding on some kind of leash, larger military formations and jurisdictions sought to introduce more systematic rationing. Yet their primary concern was to preserve not civilian lives, but the discipline and supply of their own men. Accordingly, several front-line formations sought to reduce rations for urban populations in order to give food-producing rural populations just enough to live on. By November, they were receiving high-level direction. On 4 November, Wirtschaftsstab Ost stipulated general rations of 70 grams, 2.5 ounces, of fat, half a kilogram, 18 ounces, of bread, and 2 kilograms, 4.5 pounds, of potatoes each week in the army-occupied zone. Jews and children under 14 were to be allocated half this amount. Yet the Office of Army Group South still foresaw trouble, predicting 2 days later, "Ruthless use of the land for our home supply could lead to extensive hunger revolts and plunder expeditions by those population groups who are excluded from any supply." It also echoed Wirtschaftsstab Ost, maintaining, "The agricultural population who are working for us must be protected from the starving urban proletariat. With this, demands upon the security forces will increase sharply." Perhaps the most upfront exhortation came from the commander of the 339th Infantry Division, a substandard 14th Wave formation on occupation duties. All criminals and useless eaters should be wiped out. By now, the threat of starvation and the mass destruction to towns and villages inflicted by the fighting and by the Red Army's scorched earth policies had together driven huge numbers of refugees into the countryside. In Kharkov, in the Ukraine, the 6th Army's Field Marshal von Reichenau allowed the population to head west out of the city to fend for itself. Although this risked instability and perhaps worse in the countryside, Reichenau apparently considered it preferable to keeping the ravenous population penned in, with all the increased likelihood of resistance and pestilence that this would pose. He was also concerned about the mental and material burden that the presence of so many starving civilians in the city would place upon his own men. The commander of the army does not want to have a discussion about how far Wehrmacht members should freeze for the benefit of the population. But in the countryside itself, the influx of civilians in search of food, together with the clusters of fugitive Red Army soldiers already at large there, alarmed the German military authorities severely. Such conditions, they feared, could provide a seedbed for nascent partisan groups. Even so, there was nothing resembling an effective partisan movement as yet. Resistance was particularly sparse in the north. Here, the Germans' failure to encircle large numbers of Red Army troops meant there were few fugitive Red Army soldiers at liberty in the first place. The situation was similar in much of the Ukraine, largely because it lacked the kind of terrain from which partisans could operate. Partisans were more active in the eastern Ukraine, for here the Soviet authorities had had more time to organize an underground structure and enlist civilian support before the Germans arrived. Yet even here, the Germans were able to avoid alienating the majority Ukrainian population further by targeting their reprisals against the region's ethnic Russians instead. Eastern Belarus provided all the conditions for the emergence of partisan groups. Its extensive rural areas encompassed copious forested, swampy terrain that was a gift to irregular fighters. The region was beset by social and economic chaos, and the Soviet authorities had had more time here in which to try to form partisan groups than in the more westerly areas. Eastern Belarus's rural population was also less hostile to the Stalin regime. It had suffered under collectivization, but less horrifically than the population of the Ukraine. However, even all this was not saying much, for such had been the lack of central planning for a partisan movement that, even though partisan groups were establishing themselves in eastern Belarus by the autumn of 1941, they were largely ineffective and disorganized. Nevertheless, eastern Belarus saw a perceptible increase in partisan sabotage from late summer and the growing presence of Soviet parachute troops. This created the conditions in which the German army's already overburdened, apprehensive security forces began increasingly to conduct themselves in ways that invoked not just the harshness of the criminal orders, but also the legacy of the ferocious counterinsurgency campaigns the German military had waged in wars past. By now, the occupied Soviet Union was not the only setting for burgeoning resistance. On 16 September, the OKW issued a decree for all German-occupied Europe, directing that 100 hostages be shot for every German soldier whom the partisans killed, and that 50 hostages be shot for every German soldier whom the partisans wounded. Although German army units and jurisdictions in the Soviet Union did not follow this decree to the letter, they took pitiless preventive action against any groups that might conceivably form the nuclei of future partisan units. Among other things, 16 September also saw the expiry of a deadline issued by General of Infantry von Schenkendorf, commander of the Army Group Center Rear Area, which included much of eastern Belarus. Schenkendorf had declared that every escaped Red Army soldier still roaming around in the territory between the rivers Beresina and Dnieper was to be viewed as an irregular and shot on sight. The mounting brutality German army units displayed during the anti-partisan campaign in eastern Belarus was driven not just by their growing fear and alarm. It was also driven by careerism. Ambitious officers at all levels would have seen that displaying a pitiless attitude to anti-partisan warfare was entirely in the spirit of the criminal orders, and therefore likely to win their superiors' approval. Colonel Helmut Koch commanded the 350th Infantry Regiment, a unit that operated under the 221st Security Division in the Army Group Center Rear Area. In August 1941, he urged that the Jewish question be tackled far more radically. "I suggest that all Jews living in rural areas be put under guard in labor camps. Suspect elements must be eliminated." In December, Koch was promoted and appointed commander of the 454th Security Division in the Ukraine. Another of the 221st's field officers, a Captain Brandt, bemoaned his men's purportedly weak-kneed attitude to anti-partisan warfare, writing in October, "It is unacceptable that officers have to do the shooting whilst the men watch. Most of the men are too weak. This is a sign that the true meaning of partisan warfare is something they have never learned, or at least have been badly taught." Brandt, it seems, was shooting prisoners personally, and his zeal seems to have done his career no harm. On 7 September, he was appointed commander of the 221st Specialized Motorized Partisan Combat Battalion, at that time the division's highest quality combat unit. It is worth emphasizing, in passing, that this case demonstrates that rank-and-file security troops could be less rabid in the execution of their duties. Many, if not most, probably harbored the deep aversion to partisan warfare that conventional armies share. Nevertheless, they clearly needed cajoling to be as vicious as some of their officers wished, particularly if the partisan suspects they had captured were not actually armed. Tellingly, a report on an anti-partisan warfare conference that took place in Mogilev in September 1941 stated, The constant decision between life and death for partisans and suspicious persons is difficult even for the hardest soldier. It must be done. He acts correctly who fights ruthlessly and mercilessly with complete disregard for any personal surge of emotion. Career-minded officers in the 221st Security Division may have been further incentivized to severity when they compared themselves with the SS Cavalry Brigade, which began cleansing operations in part of the 221st's jurisdiction in September. This particularly savage unit was a trailblazer, not just for brutal anti-partisan warfare, but also, more momentously, for the unfolding of the Final Solution on Soviet soil. Yet though the Army's own troops adhered to the Jew equals Bolshevik equals partisan equation, practical experience now seemed to teach them that it was the increasingly disillusioned general population, not Jews, that was more likely to succor fledgling partisan groups. Yet although most of the population was growing bitterly disillusioned at their new masters, it still largely rejected the partisan groups now emerging in its midst. Quite apart from anything else, to support them risked merciless retaliation from the Germans. But many German units, too on edge for such considerations, instead perceived potential partisan supporters all around. Hence, for instance, a report from one of the battalions of the 286th Security Division, also operating within the Army Group Center rear area on 23 September, that Bolshevik functionaries, not pro-German sympathizers, still occupied many posts in the native administration. And villagers need not have felt enamored of the Soviet cause to aid partisans or Red Army fugitives. What governed their actions instead was, in Truman Anderson's words, a pragmatic day-to-day calculus of personal survival. Excerpts from a partisan diary for September and October, found by one of Army Group North's security divisions, the 281st, described villages in which the population goes out of its way to support us, yet others where the partisans' requests for food were refused, but where the villagers told them heart-wrenching stories to convince the partisans of where their true sympathies lay. The farmers' attitude is that they'd gladly help us and have no reason to be pleased at the arrival of the Germans, but nothing doing. The Germans frighten them that much. Such cases highlighted just how conditional civilians' cooperation was. This was hardly likely to fortify the Germans' trust in the population. A security unit was particularly likely to treat the civilian population with indiscriminate brutality when its own fighting power was curtailed, as this made it more desperate. In October, for instance, the 403rd Security Division lost over 1,700 troops at a stroke when its artillery and some of its security units were transferred to duty elsewhere. The operations section then reported an almost immediate spike in partisan activity. The division's operations officer, Captain Wilhelm, issued a directive on 11 October ordering collective reprisal measures against any village where either cooperation with the partisans is uncovered or ammunition or weapons are found. And it was not just the 403rd Security Division that saw its fighting power diminish at the very same time as it saw its partisan problems dilate. For from the autumn of 1941 onwards, Army Group Center increasingly cannibalized its security divisions, sending first their fuel supply to the front line, and then, later on, their best combat units. As the autumn and the fighting both wore on, the Army's security units saw an increasingly urgent need to destroy potential sources of any future partisan movement before winter came. General von Schenkendorf, too, was extremely anxious to prevent the movement of refugees by whatever means, and individual commands like Army Rear Area 580 ordered that refugees, as a matter of principle, be arrested or liquidated. That the Army was now going after largely unarmed Red Army fugitives and civilian refugees was clearest in the yawning gap between the numbers of partisans the Germans claimed to have killed and their own paltry losses. For instance, in the 10 weeks from mid-September 1941, the 221st Security Division claimed to have killed 1,746 partisans in combat or after capture. Its own losses comprised 18 dead. The Army's pitiless security campaign also became increasingly entwined with the emergence of the Final Solution. By now, SS and police forces operating in the newly conquered areas of the Soviet Union had vastly widened their definition of which sorts of Jew constituted a security threat. The killings escalated unevenly, and for different reasons. From late July onwards, Einsatzgruppe units began to execute Jewish women and children, as well as all adult males. In doing so, they were both responding to signals from the SS leadership in Berlin and fulfilling the wishes of their own ambitious commanders, who were eager for high-level favor. Some units killed particularly large numbers of Jews because they had the means with which to do so. The SS Cavalry Brigade, a particularly mobile and well-equipped formation, had annihilated 25,000 Jews by the middle of August. All such SS and police units were acting in accordance with the practical constraints they faced, the practical opportunities they enjoyed, and a Nazi leadership principle that rewarded subordinates who showed radicalism and ruthlessness. SS and police units took full advantage of the freedom of action that high-level SS directives gave them, and after 17 July, when Hitler granted Himmler full authority to secure the eastern areas by policing measures, those orders became more radical themselves. Himmler believed that fully removing the Soviet Jews would help pave the way for a utopian reordering of Soviet and Eastern European territory, named Generalplan Ost, General Plan East. Himmler intended this reordering, which had originally been set in train following the conquest of Poland, to reach its apogee with the conquest of Soviet territory in Europe. Its end purpose was both to exploit the East economically and settle millions of Germans within it. The bulk of the racially inferior peoples already there would be resettled, but not before tens of millions had perished from the hunger and upheaval that the plan's implementation would unleash. Urban dwellers, deemed to be useless eaters, were to be hit disproportionately, while the East's food-producing agricultural populations were put to work in German service. The intelligentsia was to be annihilated. But it was Jews, whom Nazi planners considered useless eaters and the most dangerous element of the Soviet intelligentsia, who were to be targeted most systematically. In the most anti-Semitic regions of the Baltic states and the Ukraine, local auxiliaries willingly did much of the shooting themselves, albeit at the behest of the SS. Moreover, at a conference in Posen in October 1943, Himmler would assert that it had been necessary to kill all Soviet Jews, including the children, in order to prevent a generation of avengers from growing up. None of this would have been possible had the army not provided the SS and police and their native help with transport, accommodation, army manpower to cordon off execution areas and other logistical support. The ultimate responsibility for creating the atmosphere in which it became possible to annihilate the Soviet Jews and enmesh the army in the process was Hitler's. Directives from the highest level set the tone. For instance, on 12 September, Field Marshal Keitel ordered ruthless, energetic, and drastic measures above all against the Jews, the main carriers of Bolshevism. Because of the nature of their duties, rear area units were generally much more involved than frontline units. Particular assistance, as directed by army commanders, was rendered by the GFP, the intelligence sections of the various occupation units and jurisdictions, the Feldgendarmerie, and the Orts- and Feldkommandanturen. The Orts- and Feldkommandanturen were also charged with registering and ghettoizing Jews in the first place. In this, of course, they rendered the SS and police invaluable service in enabling them to get at the Jews with ease. The army also helped set the administrative framework that gifted the SS and police their increasingly free hand. In particular, General Wagner's drastic reduction of rations for the occupied population on 21 October gave the army an even greater incentive to single out Jews as useless eaters and allow the SS and police to exterminate them accordingly. The fact that many army officers and soldiers harbored anti-Semitic sentiments was not enough in itself to convert them to the cause of mass murder. However, it did make it easier for many army personnel to persuade themselves that Jews were the security threat the SS and police, not to mention the Barbarossa Decree, claimed them to be. The Wehrmacht's march through the south in September heralded a particularly colossal bout of killing in the Ukraine and Crimea. The single most infamous SS and police massacre in which the army colluded took place in late September. Einsatzgruppe C murdered 34,000 Jews in the gorge of Babi Yar outside Kiev in the jurisdiction of the Army's 29 Corps. Allied Hungarian troops and Ukrainian auxiliaries also took part. The Einsatzgruppe ensured the Army's cooperation by blaming Jews for three large fires that had broken out inside the city. Corporal B of the 296th Infantry Division, stationed in Kiev at the time, certainly swallowed this story if his letter of 28